2025 is the closing date of Diablo Canyon. Is there any chance you're going to get it closed earlier than that? That's, what, 9 years away?
Well, you know, there are lots and lots of people who have fought for many decades to shut Diablo Canyon down. And I think that it's important to recognize that all of us together are going to continue to try to do everything we can to assure safety and protect the environment. And I want to make clear that one of the things the agreement specifically says is that in no way does this agreement seek to stop in any way the work of Friends of the Earth or other organizations and activists to continue to fight to make sure that we're safe and that the environment is safe. So I think, you know, the battle is going to continue in the meantime, but this agreement means it's the end of Diablo and the end of nuclear power in California. It's pretty dramatic.
Damon Moglen, want to thank you for being with us, Senior Strategic Advisor for Friends of the Earth, one of the group's lead negotiators for closing down Diablo Canyon nuclear plant. And that does it for our broadcast. I'll be speaking tonight at 7:30 at 99 Madison in New York City with Chris Hedges, Jeremy Scahill, and others, marking Julian Assange's 4 years in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And on Saturday at the WAM NYC Gender, Justice, and Media Conference at Barnard College at 4. Check Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
This is KBOO Portland.
Stay up late with Lanita Duke and Grassroot News on Wednesday, June 22nd from 10 p.m. until midnight, as we celebrate the music of Roberta Flack, as well as agitating for social change. Remember, stay up late with me when 10 p.m. B.O.
Book and record sales. This is a great shelves and turn your old book to cash. For them to KBOO Monday through Friday. We're accepting donation CDs and DVD August 10th. The sale will be held in mid-August. Please, that's VHS. If you have questions, please email Ani at 103-231-8032, extension 213.
Evening news, well, in part by KBOO Foundation members, Victory, gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1990, available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, amidst a growing lead scandal in Portland's public school water fountains, Portland Public Schools Superintendent Carol Smith will retire at the end of this month.
Members of Congress protested themselves on the House floor today.
And academics are gathered in the direction of climate change and the influx of residents to the Pacific Northwest.
Evening, this is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 22nd, 2016. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Oil has spilled in the Columbia River Gorge. It had two leaked from a train that was trapped 25 miles. It came from a diesel locomotive on Tuesday evening. The train had indications are that the diesel fuel did not enter any waterways or into the Columbia River itself. Some of the fuel may have evaporated. The leak in Bridal Veil comes close on the heels of an oil train derailment and fire in Mosier on June 3rd. That accident spilled 42,000 gallons of highly flammable Bakken crude oil from North Dakota. The resulting fire caused the evacuation of over 100 Mosier residents who also lost plumbing and sewer services. The environmental groups and residents have been trying to stop oil trains in the gorge, but Union Pacific Railroad has indicated that they will resume transporting oil later this week. The Oregon Department of Transportation has called for a temporary moratorium on oil trains traveling through the gorge.
Portland Public Schools kicked off district-wide water testing at long-shuttered Humboldt School and found that 38 of 84 faucets throughout the school had unacceptably high lead levels. One water spigot tested at more than 60 times a federal threshold. The district conceded that it will not be able to fix every source of tainted water in every school before classes resume in August. The district plans to pay an outside company to deliver fresh water for drinking and cooking to all schools in the coming year. Kairos Charter School is expected to move into the Humboldt School building during the coming school year under a rental agreement with Portland Public Schools. Kairos is aimed specifically at children of color and underserved communities. This spring, tests at Crescent Elementary and Rose City School also turned up multiple instances of elevated lead levels in water used for drinking and cooking. Portland Public Schools leaders have known about widespread problems with lead in many of its schools since testing was conducted during the summer of 2001.
Portland Public Schools Superintendent Carol Smith announced in an open letter that she will be retiring effective June of next year. Smith has been under pressure since high levels of lead were identified in the drinking water of at least two schools. While she did not tie her decision to step down at the end of her contract directly to the controversy, she did acknowledge that water quality is a priority issue for the district and that investments will need to be made. In her letter, Smith listed several accomplishments the district achieved during her nearly 10 years on the job, including passing a $482 million construction bond, increasing high school graduation rates, and building career technical education capacity. She did, however, note that these successes require the district to prioritize needs, with one result being underinvestment in facilities maintenance and business infrastructure.
The Portland Housing Bureau announced today they'll be purchasing the Joyce Hotel for $4.22 million and rolling it over to Central City Concern to continue operating as low-income housing. Tuesday's purchase agreement is the city's second offer on the property since a 90-day eviction notice was issued to the building's residents on December 31st. Housing officials said in a statement they first offered to buy the building in March to try keeping existing tenants in place, but the owner turned down the offer and more than half the residents were forced out. The hotel has been a key affordable housing resource in the city center for many years, offering rooms for $19 to $50 per night. Located at Southwest 11th and Stark Streets, the Joyce has 69 rooms. Portland Housing Bureau Director Kurt Krieger said the new city no-net loss policy was a major factor in their decision to offer more money and purchase the building. Under the policy, the city committed to maintaining 8,286 affordable rental units in the central city. Officials confirmed the remaining residents will be moved out while workers carry out a building rehab plan to fix outstanding health and safety issues.
Dozens of members of Congress, led by civil rights pioneer John Lewis, launched a sit-in on the House floor this morning demanding action on gun control legislation. The Republican leadership of the House responded by halting the chamber session and then by cutting off the C-SPAN cameras to prevent the sit-in from being broadcast. Supportive senators from the Senate side of the Capitol, such as Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, walked over to the House chamber to show their solidarity. Connecticut Congressman and co-organizer John Larson vowed, "We are going to be here for a long time." Nell Abram from Free Speech Radio News has more.
Rise up, Democrats. Rise up, Americans. This cannot stand. We will occupy this floor. We will no longer be denied a right to vote. I yield to our majority whip and leader. We sit down.
The gentleman's time has expired. Pursuant to clause 12 per N.A. of Rule 1, chair declares the House in recess till the hour of 12 noon.
With that, House Democratic Whip, Maryland Representative Steny Hoyer, officially started the sit-in. And immediately, Acting Speaker Pro Tem Daniel Webster closed the session. Dozens of Democrats sat down at the front of the House chamber, saying they would stay there until House Republicans allow a vote on legislation to address gun violence.
Mr. Speaker, where is the heart of this body? Where is our soul? Where is our moral leadership? Where is our courage?
The protest started after civil rights veteran, Georgia Democrat John Lewis, delivered an impassioned speech.
We cannot continue to stick our heads in the sand and ignore the reality of mass gun violence in our nation. Deadly mass shootings are becoming more and more frequent. Mr. Speaker, this is a fight. It is not an opinion. We must remove the blinders. The time for silence and patience is long gone. We are calling on the leadership of the House to bring common sense gun control legislation to the House floor. Give us a vote. Let us vote. We came here to do our job. We came here to work.
C-SPAN cameras, which are toggled off and on when Congress goes in and out of session, stopped broadcasting as soon as Representative Webster closed the morning hour. They started again when the House reconvened to resume its work at noon. Protesting lawmakers were still gathered in the front of the chamber, chanting, "No bill, no break." They quieted for the official prayer and Pledge of Allegiance, but as soon as the Speaker pro tem tried to kick off business as usual, the chanting resumed. Once again, the Speaker recessed the House and C-SPAN cameras went dark. But California Congressman Scott Peters was on the floor streaming live video on Periscope, which C-SPAN then rebroadcast.
This is the right thing to do.
The call to action in the House follows a 15-hour filibuster last week in the Senate. That action ended with GOP leadership agreeing to schedule votes on gun control legislation. Those votes, held Monday, all failed. Senate Leader Mitch McConnell has agreed to bring a compromise bill, the Terrorist Firearms Prevention Act of 2016, to the floor for a vote as early as this week. For FSRN, I'm Nell Abram.
Today, the U.S. Senate came within a single vote of giving the FBI broad powers to gather internet records, browser histories, and email data without a court order. The bill was sponsored by Arizona Republican John McCain and Texas Republican John Cornyn, who invoked the Orlando shooting. The Obama administration has been pushing to give the FBI this power for years. Critics reacted swiftly. The ACLU issued a statement urging lawmakers to abandon the effort. Oregon Senator Ron Wyden criticized Senate Republicans for, quote, pushing fake, knee-jerk solutions that will do nothing to prevent mass shootings for terrorist attacks. Critics also noted that the Republican-controlled Senate was advocating a further reduction of the privacy rights of Americans while continuing to support nearly unlimited rights for gun owners. Senator Mitch McConnell changed his yes vote to no at the last minute, raising concerns that the bill will be reintroduced at a later date.
KBOO's political poet Dan Raphael has a desperate plea. Can we vote yet?
Can we vote now? The president has so little power. Campaign promises seldom do flower. This extended campaign has benumbed our poor brains while the rich just get richer each hour. With Obama's term close to ending, Republicans can stop their pretending. It's because he is black they refuse to do jack, and our country's deep woes keep extending. Nor will I forget Donald Trump, who knows his supporters are chumps, building his own reputation while dividing the nation, making America a mean, toxic dump. Making it harder for people to vote keeps the powerful in control of this boat, rigging elections while avoiding detection, making democracy soon just a footnote. The Democratic Party sabotaged him. The major media ignored him, but Bernie's not done encouraging everyone that our revolution is only beginning. This is Dan Raphael and Poetic Justice.
Next Monday, the Oregon Free Trade Campaign's Bad Trade Kills Good Jobs movement brings its leaflet campaign against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, to U.S. Representative Suzanne Bonamici's office in Southwest Portland. On Tuesday, they will be at U.S. Representative Earl Blumenauer's office on Northeast 11th Avenue. This week, KBOO's Labor Radio spoke with the executive director of the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign, Michael Shannon, on how the TPP might impact Oregon.
And the tour is coming to the Portland metro area on 10:30 a.m. Monday, June 27th. We're going to be at Representative Bonamici's office in Beaverton. And on Tuesday, June 28th at noon, we're going to be at Representative Earl Blumenauer's office in the Lloyd Center District of Portland, Oregon. So I kind of actually very early in my social change career did brush up against trade and saw it as something that was a place where corporations were starting to exercise their power in new and dangerous ways, particularly back then around environmental policy, and NAFTA did turn out to be a real problem when it came to environmental policy. And the TPP is just more of the same, but there's a lot of people out there who don't really have a strong feeling about it because it's so big. And I think that's part of the strategy. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, should it be ratified, which we will not let it be, but should it be, does have a minimum wage requirement. You know what it is? That there is a minimum wage, meaning a penny a day would allow for a country to be operating under TPP rules if they set their minimum wage at a penny a day. Now, I understand that there are countries of different sizes and different levels of development across the TPP signatories, but not even a formula, not even a guideline, just you have to have one with zero guidance, zero enforceability on what that would, if that could actually be made into a living wage. It's because that is not a requirement that's existed in past free trade deals, which also says something about NAFTA, CAFTA, and the past ones, but they're putting that forward as a great improvement. And when they say it very broadly, people are like, oh, it's better now. But then when you have to dig into the policy to learn that it is not better, and in fact, by putting it in, it's something of a strategy to get more bad policy passed. There is a lot of misinformation out there, particularly in February when the Trans-Pacific Partnership was signed in a very ceremonial, all the trade reps from all the countries got together in New Zealand, and they signed it. What that all meant was a very nice ceremony for everyone to get a photo op. It has to be ratified by all legislative bodies of all 12 countries. The Citizen Trade Campaign and Global Trade Watch, my national allies, broke down the numbers by states. We're looking at 95,000 Oregonians working in manufacturing sectors that are projected to see worsening trade deficits. Mm. Only just over 500 Oregonians work in the one manufacturing sector expected to see gains, and that's petroleum and coal, which we have to quickly note, how much growth do we want? The top agricultural export for the state of Oregon is wheat. We'll see a decline of exports under the TPP. Forest products will also likely see declines of exports under the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So we're looking at the core of what we have left, I have to be blunt about that, of our manufacturing base here in the state, but also looking at dangers to our really, not thriving might be a strong word, but strong agricultural and forest service products. We're going to see further declines. And that's the best possible projection the U.S. government can put.
Climate change-driven migration is the subject of a special symposium this week by the Portland State University College of Urban and Public Affairs and the University of Washington Climate Impacts Group. The event is this Friday in Portland, but it is already sold out. Organizers say it is just the beginning of a collaboration aimed at figuring out what's happening now and what might happen in the future as the Northwest's reputation for livability draws an unprecedented crowd of new residents fleeing from heat waves, hurricanes, and tidal waves. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke about the symposium with Urban Planning Assistant Professor Jason Gergovich of Portland State University. He's also the Assistant Director of the PSU Population Research Center. Tune in to the KBOO News tomorrow night at 5:45 for the full interview, but here's a taste.
Well, this Friday, we're convening an event called The Winds of Change and exploring climate change-driven migration to the Pacific Northwest. We're convening that event through PSU and through the University of Washington Climate Impacts Group. And what the main purpose of the event is to bring together climate scientists, social scientists, planning practitioners, and interested members of the public to have a discussion about climate change related impacts specifically to domestic migration. So looking at the likelihood of people moving to Oregon and Washington from California, Arizona, Nevada as climate change starts to impact those regions, and the related set of questions that follow with those movements of people.
And I heard you say earlier that you're at capacity for this important kickoff event. What does that mean? I mean, who's coming?
Yeah, so we're having the event at EcoTrust, and so we have 150 in terms of the capacity, and we're already at capacity. There's a lot of interest in this topic, particularly in Portland as well as in Seattle, about these places already being attractive destinations for young folks as well as for retirees because of the economic growth in both of those regions, but then also this sort of other important factor, which we know far less about, which is climate-based migration. So as people start to think about 115-degree temperatures in Phoenix and Tucson and what likely changes will happen in the next 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years, as well as water impacts, electricity impacts. What do those changes portend in Portland and Seattle? And I think the 150 people already being registered for the event, this being a kickoff event, there's a lot of interest in wanting to engage in the issue, particularly around making sure that we're doing the things necessary to plan for the numbers of people here in Portland as well as in Seattle.
Who will be the speakers at this event? Is this is it scholars or is it government policy planners or what?
Sure. We have three plenary speakers in the morning. The first speaker is Jose Miguel Guzman. He is a former population forecaster with the UN and now works for a consulting firm in Washington, D.C. The second speaker is Dr. David Plain, who is a nationally recognized migration scholar at the University of Arizona. And the third speaker is Dr. Robert McLemon, who is from Wilfrid Laurier University in Canada. And he does a lot of work internationally on human environment, the intersection of human environment, so environmental impacts and how it affects human activity.
What are some of the obstacles, as you were just discussing, obstacles to understanding how to use what we know or obstacles to trying to figure out our policies for the future so we don't have so many people living in the street?
I think one of the big challenges methodologically is that people move for a lot of different reasons. And as somebody who studies migration, it's fascinating in terms of talking to people about how they make the decision to move to a given place. And so you think about the importance of jobs and economics. You think about the importance of crime and family decisions, so couples making decisions, kids, schools, access to environmental factors, right? So for us, it's proximity to the gorge that's often cited as a reason, proximity to the coast. And so climate is one of those factors. It's always been climate for a long time. People have been moving for climate for a long time, for decades. Moving for climate for
this is not
new. I think the difficulty is new. Is that historical trends of why people move for climate is that they're often viewed as an amenity. Right in the sense of moving to the south and the west because the adequate sunshine is better than one of the past years because of the adequate sunshine.
But thinking about climate as a disc, but thinking about climate as a disc, right, in the sense of it being a negative factor, right, in the sense of becoming too hot, right? And moving in the opposite direction to escape, moving in the opposite direction to escape high temperatures or low sources of water.
At what point do people start to change their behavior?
Do people start to change
when climate actually pushes them out of a given climate
actually pushes them out of
that's kind of a question that, right, that we want to frame in this discussion
that
on Friday.
That we want to frame in this discussion on Friday
and saying, what do we know about this issue?
And saying, what do we know about the issue?
And how do we actually move forward in terms of addressing the information and research gaps and what we don't know?
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
The Oregon Country Fair happens again from July 8th to July 10th in Vinita, Oregon. Now in its 47th year, the fair started in 1969 as a benefit for an alternative school. It has a rich history of alternative arts, performance, philanthropy, and the emergence each year of a full city of alternative living. KBOO's Lisa Loving talked with Tom Gannon, the general manager of the fair, about what's new at the fair and about efforts to include communities that have not traditionally attended the fair.
We are on the line with Tom Gannon. He's the general manager of the Oregon Country Fair, which is coming up next week. Tom, what's new at the fair this year?
Well, we have our whole new area called Zavanadu. It's been renamed. It was new last year, but it's a rotating mix of acts and art pieces and all sorts of really neat stuff. So that's going to seem all new, and certainly if you haven't been to the fair in a long time, it's going to be brand new to you. It's really neat. It's wide open. It's really one of the better places at the fair if you want to get away from a crowd. Pretty awesome. And, of course, we have lots of new acts, lots of new jugglers, lots of new some new vendors even. So we're pretty excited.
Okay, Tom. Now, last year was the first year that we saw applique fabric banners in the trees that say Black Lives Matter. I get the sense that the fair has been working on inclusion and equity. Can you talk about that? What specific things has the Oregon Country Fair done to reach out to new audiences?
What we're doing right now is direct outreach by supplying free passes to folks and identified communities who we feel have been historically underrepresented in the Oregon Country Fair. So we've been providing free VIP passes and day passes to folks in the Latino community, the African American community, the Native American community, really trying to get folks to just come out and check it out risk-free and see if it's something that they think they could like.
Do you have a vision or specific goals around that?
You know, we try to be as inclusive as we possibly can. And essentially what our vision is to create a welcoming and open environment for anyone who wants to come and enjoy themselves at the country fair. So if we do have any single vision, it's to make everyone feel like they're welcome and that they can get something out of what we do and have a great time.
Okay, big picture, the Oregon Country Fair, it's one of the biggest, one of the most rooted community celebrations in the state of Oregon for many decades now. And it is a community of people also who are dedicated to social justice and social justice agendas. Can you, Tom, talk just briefly about why is the Oregon Country Fair, as the Spoon Man says, an essential event? How does it weave into society and become more than just entertainment?
Well, the Oregon Country Fair isn't just an event. We're also a philanthropic, nonprofit organization. We donate quite a few money, over $1 million in the past 20 years, to different nonprofits, other nonprofits or social service groups to give back to the community. We have the Jill Hyman Fund, which is one of our major mechanisms for giving away money, which mostly goes to social services, direct community services. And then we also have the board of directors who do kind of act as a bit of a nonprofit incubator, because they'll give small grants to virtually anyone with a good idea to come on in and say, hey, you know, we have this idea. We want to try something out. We haven't, you know, been able to get funding from other places, and we're willing to take the risk often for some of these smaller groups to do things like that. And again, you know, the Oregon Country Fair really is not just a three-day event. It's a larger community, and we try to perpetuate the ideals of that community to the best that we can. And those include really, you know, love and peace, and that's really what we're about. And if we think we can do that while having a really good time also.
Okay, Tom, I only have one question left. Can I get a camping pass, please, Tom, please? I'm just kidding.
Media is always welcome. I'll see what I can do.
All right. We've been speaking with Tom Gannon. He's the general manager of the Oregon Country Fair. Tom, thanks for taking a few minutes in your busy day.
Thank you.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
The watchdog group Global Witness released a report declaring the year 2015 to have had the most recorded killings of environmental defenders in recent history. This is a 65% increase from 2014. 185 killings in 16 different countries last year have been documented, amounting to more than 3 deaths per week. Countries that rank the worst on the list include Brazil, the Philippines, and Colombia. Across the board, however, killings related to anti-mining activities spiked highest, resulting in 42 overall deaths for 2015. Global Witnesses reports makes calls for government intervention. The list of solutions offered in the report include increasing the protection of land and environmental activists, increasing the investigation of crimes against those activists, supporting activists to defend their land, and resolving the underlying issues of corruption in each of these affected countries.
It's 5:28. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Early this year, former Governor Rick Oops Perry was strutting around the country bragging about the Texas economic miracle he says he created. The only miracle, however, was that he actually fooled some people into believing his flimflam. Perry claimed that he had generated 1 million new jobs through a little agency that he controlled called the Texas Enterprise Fund. It doled out millions of taxpayer dollars to corporations, subsidizing them to relocate or expand in Texas in exchange for them increasing their workforce. But oops! A 2014 audit found that the fund was a crony capitalism scam, with much of the state money going to Perry campaign donors and with little enforcement of the job creation pledges. In 2013, for example, the beaming miracle worker announced that he had cut a deal with Chevron to build a 50-story office tower in Houston, The state would put up $12 million, and Chevron would hire 1,700 new employees to work there. 3 years later, Perry's gone. The tower is nothing but a vacant lot. Chevron says it, quote, does not anticipate building a new office in Houston. And a recent investigation by the Texas Tribune found that the oil giant has eliminated 1,500 jobs in Houston during the past year. Indeed, it appears to employ fewer Houstonians today than when the deal was cut. Yet, incredibly, Perry's successor insists Chevron is in full compliance with its Enterprise Fund agreement. How can that be? Because Governor Miracle filled the agreement with weasel words that effectively allow the corporation to claim job creation while actually cutting jobs. This is Jim Hightower saying, now that really is a miracle. And of course, a fraud. But that's what corporate welfare is, whether it comes from Washington, your state capital, or City Hall. To help stop the flimflammers, go to goodjobsfirst.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Love and Revolution Radio at 6 o'clock. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather should be showers with a high around 62 degrees. Today in history, in 1938, heavyweight boxing champion Joe Louis knocked out Max Schmeling of Germany in the first round of their rematch in New York City's Yankee Stadium. Our quote of the day is from said Joe Louis, who said, "Everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die."
Since the installation of the Palestinian Authority in 1994, cancer patients in the Gaza Strip receive medical care outside of the territory. Over the past years, movement of these patients on border crossings has been notably affected by political developments in the region. FSRN's Rami Almagari files this story about a seven-year-long cancer patient from Gaza.
Fawzia Al-Ghifari is in her late 30s and lives in the central Gaza Strip town of Nusayrat. She is back home now, 4 weeks after receiving a new round of a treatment for thyroid cancer in nearby Egypt, where she must go every 6 months for follow-up and medication. Because of travel restrictions on Gaza residents, she must leave her three kids behind every time she goes to Cairo for therapy. And while Al-Ghifari's treatment only takes 1 to 2 weeks, the trips themselves can take months. That's because the Rafah crossing terminal, the sole outlet to the outside world for Gaza's 1.9 million residents, is completely closed for prolonged periods of time.
When the thyroxine runs out of my body after about 3 weeks, I reach a point of being unable to even stand on my feet. At this point, I'm forced to stay in bed or be admitted to the local hospital of Al-Aqsa to receive vitamins that could help a little. Every 6 months, I have to go back to the same Cairo hospital for a PET scan so doctors can decide the right dose for me.
On her most recent trip, Al-Ghifari was stranded in Cairo for 3 months, cleared by her doctors to return home, but unable to get back into Gaza, while the Rafah crossing terminal remained closed.
The most heartbreaking moment for me was when Mother's Day came around and I was stranded in Cairo. My kids took photos of some gifts for me and sent them through Viber. Right after I returned from Cairo, they put all their gifts on the table and celebrated a late Mother's Day with me.
During these medication-related trips to Cairo, Falastine Al-Ghifari, a 22-year-old university graduate, takes care of Fawzia's three kids, who range in age from 5 to 10 years old. Falastine is the niece of Fawzia's husband.
In general, the children are very tense. Shadi, for example, can be very stubborn. Once we boiled some corn and Shadi insisted that he wanted the largest piece of corn while his two other sisters insisted on the same. Their grandmother and I tried to cool them down by promising that next time they could take turns having the largest piece. Yet it was in vain as they were not convinced. They are still little kids.
Some patients are able to get medical care in the West Bank and the occupied East Jerusalem. But since 1994, the Palestinian Authority has been forced to refer many critically ill patients from the West Bank and Gaza to hospitals inside Israel, Jordan, and Egypt. Healthcare services in the Gaza Strip suffer from chronic shortages of specialized medications and lack equipment for high-tech imagery tests like PET scans or MRIs. Ashraf Al-Qidra is a spokesperson for the Gaza-based health ministry.
The shortages prevent 30% of Gaza patients from receiving proper, complete medical service. The Ministry of Health has acquired some vital equipment at Gaza's hospitals, mainly CT and MRI scans. We managed to get three machines, which are located in the Shifa, European Gaza, and the Indonesian hospitals.
But barring very minor treatments, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, and tumor removal surgeries are unavailable within the coastal territory. Fawzia Al-Ghifari's husband, Abdul Razak, accompanies her on her medical visits to Cairo when he can, and says each trip can become extremely expensive. The costs include hotels, food, and transport. Like many working-age men in Gaza's battered economy, Abdul Razak is unemployed. Fawzia's own monthly salary as a Palestinian Authority employee is modest. And when he can't go with her, Abdul Razak says it's very stressful.
This is really a burden. On the one hand, you should take care of your children, giving them the needed care. On the other hand, you should keep in constant contact with your patient who is out of town, and thus your burden becomes triple. For example, when she comes back to Gaza and while on the road from Cairo, I feel very worried that she might get harmed if a violent clash occurs. On her road back to Gaza, telecommunications happen to cut off.
The Palestinian Authority has recently laid the foundation for a specialized cancer treatment hospital in the West Bank city of Ramallah to meet the medical needs of cancer patients from the occupied Palestinian territories, including Gaza. But Fawzia Al-Ghifari can't bet her life waiting for the hospital to open any time in the near future. Rami Al-Mighari, Afasaran, Gaza.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Economic Policy Institute President Larry Michel is urging the Democratic Party to adopt robust economic platform planks that will really help working people and the U.S. economy. He says raising wages and beefing up labor standards is essential. He says four things are critical to raising wages across the board for American workers.
One is to get full employment and keep it there. Two is to rebuild labor standards, most prominently the minimum wage, but we need to deal with misclassification and wage theft, protect the overtime rule, all those sorts of things. Three, we need to rebuild a system of collective bargaining. But that I'm very dissatisfied with the current system of collective bargaining. I think we have to revise it wholesale and move towards occupational sectoral bargaining. The fourth part, we have to really think about constraining the growth of incomes at the top. What the top 1% has gained is incomes that otherwise would have flowed to the bottom 99%.
Michel says Democrats have often been too weak when it comes to collective bargaining rights and expanding and modernizing labor standards.
It is true that Democrats sometimes have been far too weak in both fighting for higher labor standards, expanding labor standards to include things like sick leave and family leave and scheduling, and definitely been too weak on making sure that people have the real right to join a union and to engage in collective bargaining. And that is just a reflection of that there's a class struggle within the Democratic Party as well as between the parties.
According to a report from Moody's Analytics, if Donald Trump's economic policies were adopted, America's economy could suffer a prolonged recession that would hurt low and middle income workers the most. The report says under almost any scenario, the U.S. economy would be more isolated and diminished if Trump's economic policies were followed. 2012 Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney agrees with Moody's that Trump's policies would be disastrous for workers and the economy.
If Donald Trump's plans were ever implemented, the country would sink into prolonged recession. He would be very bad for American workers and for American families.
Hillary Clinton, speaking in Ohio Tuesday, said Trump's written a lot of books about business, but they all seem to end at Chapter 11, a reference to Trump's business bankruptcies. Clinton's campaign says Wednesday she'll lay out a progressive economic agenda to help workers.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Bank of Labor has earned the reputation as a leader in union business lending by understanding the needs of labor unions. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Ray Bodwell, and John Pacheco. The producer is Theo Burke, who also provided our live piano music today. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Contrary to what I said a few minutes ago, after news from the BOO at 6 o'clock, we will not be broadcasting Love and Revolution. Instead, we'll have the monthly broadcast of The Underground brought to you by the KBOO Youth Collective. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Voices from the Edge Talk Radio, Joanne Hardesty hosts a discussion of a new report on racial disparities in state prisons that provides evidence of a disproportionately high rate of incarceration for black Oregonians. At 9 o'clock, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, it's Air Cascadia with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, host Bethany Grabo talks with Laura O. Foster, author of the new book Walking with Ramona, Exploring Beverly Cleary's Portland. And at 11:30 on The Film Show, Ibrahim Mubarak talks about the upcoming documentary screening of Right to Survive, Breaking the Chains, and comedy writer and author Steve Young explains exactly what an industrial musical is. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a KBOO member currently, you can become one right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Thank you. It is 5:45, time now for News from the Boo, our weekly program where we talk about folks inside of the KBOO station, about what's going on here at the station and in the greater KBOO listening community. Tonight, we're talking with KBOO volunteer and podcaster Christopher Francisco, who will be live reporting on KBOO from the Leonard Peltier Freedom Ride this July. We'll hear about that project, and we'll speak with him tonight. Along with Christopher, we have Brent Jorgensen. Hello to Christopher and Brent. How are you both doing tonight?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Excellent. So, Christopher, let's start with you. You're a volunteer, and you have a podcast here at KBOO, Human Beings with Five Fingers. Tell us about the podcast and its mission.
It's called Dinelai, which means human beings with five finger in Dinelai language. And what I do is I interview my people, Dinelai people,